Book session number 13236, Reel 2.
Yes.
Mr. Mail, Reel 1. A Reel 2.
We schooled in very pleasant surroundings, a tented camp, had lots of leave, of course, and whilst there they found I was entitled to a long leave because I'd been torpedoed up in the Mediterranean, and I chose to go to a farm, at a 10,000 acre farm called Del Crewe. I still write to the daughter still now, and she's been to see us here in England, and we've been to see her in South Africa. Had a wonderful 14 days on a 10,000 acre farm, hunting and shooting and bathing in the rivers, lovely. Then, of course, we came back to our schooling, and all of a sudden we were told that the 19 Commissioner Warrant candidates, of which I was one, were told that we were drafted back to Durban to join a destroyer called the Inconstant, and we would help to make a steaming party to take her home. So instead of commissioning down in Port Elizabeth, I came home and commissioned here in England.
Was that South African farming family of British origin?
Yes,
or
they were.
Of Boer origin?
They'd gone out there pre the Boer War. And the original Mr. Smythe, their names were, the original Mr. Smythe had been the first and only Prime Minister of Natal. Then I suppose they federated, and there was. But they were quite a county class people, they really were. They did us very well indeed. Lovely time.
So you went back to Britain in the Inconstant?
Inconstant, which is an old destroyer. We escorted the Valiant back home, the battleship Valiant.
And was the Inconstant in good condition?
Well, no, she had the kind of damage, apparently, which could only be repaired back in England. And whilst the crew had only just arrived out there, we took their places and steamed her home.
Did you run into the enemy on the way?
Not at all. We did gun practice, of course. All the evolutions were gone through day and night because we were a scratch crew. It normally takes about 6 weeks to shake a naval ship's company down into something like shape. And we were a completely scratch crew, so the skipper wasn't very pleased about that. Especially escorting a battleship, you know, with a flag officer aboard.
When was this that you made this voyage back to Britain?
I came in March 43.
And on arrival?
I went into Portsmouth Barracks, and of course that began the commissioning process. Eventually I was sent to port to King Alfred at Brighton, and there you go through various boards again and again and again. And there were so many people being required at that stage for the invasion fleet that they had an offshoot place in Loch Ailort in Scotland, and I was sent there to commission. That was more, not only was it a school, but it was a toughening up process. It was assumed that the living condition would be so spartan aboard landing craft that we had to be tough physically as well as mentally. And they put us through assault courses, wading frozen rivers, climbing mountains, as well as doing all our schooling to commission. There were weekly exams, and if you failed, you went back to sea. I think about half who set out finally made the last exam.
Was there any aspect of the landing training that you found difficult to cope with?
I was pretty fit. I was lucky. We had endless rifle drills, endless assault courses. If you failed along the way, as I say, not only did you fail your academic exams, but you failed your physical exams, and you were sent back. You were pushed to your limits, both mentally and physically.
Who's in charge of all this?
A commander who was a. A sadist, I would think. I don't know his name. In fact, I hadn't better mention his name anyway. Yes, he kept us going day and night. And in the final week, we had to climb a mountain called Anstack. And, oh, by God, that was hard going. In PT kit, It was snowing and raining hard and blowing. And when we got to the very top, he was there, taking our names even. We thought we might, you know, skive half the way up, but he was at the top himself, in full uniform, and we had on PT kit.
How had he got up?
I've no idea, but he was there. And we had, and the final test of our ability to, or the will to win, was a boxing match. We were matched against each other weight by weight, and we had 3 3-minute rounds. And the more blood you produced, the better he was pleased.
Did you know what you were training for?
Yes, we knew landing craft of some kind or other had to be the answer, yes. Yep.
Did you guess where it would be?
Oh no, we had no idea, not where the invasion was going to be, except in the channel somewhere, obviously, but not where. And then when you passed out, of course, you came home on leave and went back for... You then did a further 6 weeks officer under training course, where in order that everyone knew you were being trained, you wore grey flannel trousers and a white muffler, so that your table manners were under observation all the time, and your conduct in general was always under review. Then you picked up a ship. My first ship was I had to go to Middlesbrough, and we commissioned a brand new Mark IV LCT, number 628.
Can you tell me what an LCT was like?
Well, the living conditions were Spartan again. You had a wardroom which was about 12 feet by 8, in which, of course, two officers lived. Your seats became your bunks at night. And if you wanted to use the wardrobe, you had to pull the table down. You washed in an old tin can which tipped up into another tin can. They couldn't even afford to give you a pipe to flush the water overboard, even. It was pretty grim. The food was good. The food was plain and good, you know. But how the crews lived in them, I'll never know. They lived actually in the engine room among enormous great Paxman Ricardo engines. The noise was unbelievable. And they ate and slept and wrote their letters down there.
What rank of captain did you have?
A sub-lieutenant. We were both sub-lieutenants. I was the Jimmy and he was the captain. And we had a Motormac engineer, which was a petty officer, and the leading seaman, and all the rest were seamen or stokers.
So it was very junior people who were in charge.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. And we brought her right down, right through the channel, with no lighthouses, no lightships, no radar. You know, I mean, you've got all these aids to navigation these days.
Did you feel nervous about it?
No good to, was it? Not a bit of good to. We came through Dover after dark quite deliberately, and that was hairy because, of course, luckily we were shallow vessels. We had no trouble about going aground on the shoal, not really, but we hared through there as fast as we could. Then we took around to Milford Haven, and did all our working up trials. We had tanks and every conceivable kind of vessel vehicle was brought aboard. We loaded them on one beach and steamed down and discharged them on the other, over and over again until we knew what was expected of us. And then we came round to Plymouth, which was the final build-up, and we joined Q-57 squadron there. That was a squadron of LCTs which were being kept in reserve after D-Day in case of casualties. But about 9 or 10 days before, of course we didn't know when D-Day was going to be, but 9 days prior to that, two of us were detached and sent to Portland to become attached to the American Army.
To what were detached?
Two LCTs were detached from the squadron, and we sailed up to Portland. But when we got to Dartmouth, our port engine blew to pieces, and we crippled in there on one engine, and they quickly decided that they'd take the engine out and put a new one in. And with all the Operation Overlord aboard, we steamed from Dartmouth to Portland unescorted. If we'd been attacked by E-boats, which had attacked the Slapton Sands only 6 weeks previous, they would have had all the Operation Overlord and the lot. And we came from Dartmouth unescorted to Portland with all the Operation Overlord aboard.
This is LCT 628?
LCT 628, yes. Then we loaded... we were attached to the American Assault Engineers, We loaded General Grant tanks and drew off and waited Ike to say let's go. And then from there on to the following December, we did 23 round trips to the beaches and back.
What impression did the American Army make on you in 1944?
Their initial troops were first class, but as the day wore on, they were a pretty ropey lot. But what we enjoyed most about working with the Yanks was they gave us their K rations. See? So apart from, or as well as living on our own rations, which we had to buy, we could live off theirs for nothing. It was jolly good.
So they were generous?
Very generous, very generous.
But why were the later ones so ropey?
Well, I suppose they look as though they came from a different part of the country. They could have been even Indians or Puerto Ricans or... not blacks exactly, but they were a different breed altogether. But of course, by this time, the army was well on the way to Paris and beyond. They secured the beachheads and they were away, you know.
But you mean they were inexperienced compared to the first?
Well, I wouldn't know what training they'd had, but they didn't look as sharp a troop. But in fact, we send our guardsmen in first, don't we? You know, it's the way it goes. These could have been what did we call them? We call them we had whole regiments of pickaxe and shovel people, didn't we?
Pioneers,
yes.
And the Grant tanks, did they impress you?
Oh, yes. Especially the way, of course, they had to be backed into the ship, down the beach, up the ramp, backed in, two abreast, and then we had to chain them down and scotch them up. Scotch, a big scotcher, so they wouldn't move if the sea got rough. They wouldn't slide about on the deck.
How do you scotch them, though?
We scotched them with great balks of wood under the tank tracks, and then we bottle screwed each one down. Each tank had four bottle screws.
What's a bottle screw?
A method of connection, and you screw, and it tightens up until this is all held rigid. And we took in 12 on D-Day. 80 tons each, they were.
On D-Day itself?
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we moved backwards and forwards, coming... until the following December, we did 23 round trips across the channel from Portland.
When you went in on D-Day, which beach did you go into?
Utah.
Was that the bad one or not?
It was the worst of the Americans, but even so, by the afternoon, we saw not one German aircraft over the beaches all the time I was over there.
And what time of day did you first go in on D-Day?
About 20 minutes after D-morning, 20 minutes late. Well, not late.
After H-hour.
That's right, D plus H, H plus 20. Mm. The great sight was watching the warspite bombard the... between the American beaches and ours, there was a line of cliffs, and the Germans had put big gun emplacements on the top of them, and the Air Force had tried to bomb them, I gather, and there was no result. They brought the warspite into about 8 or 9 miles away, and she blew the cliffs away. Not just the guns, the cliffs went, or the tops of the cliffs. And of course, the great sight too was the landing craft, in which there was about 100 rockets, and these just decimated the beach as they went in. They cleared a great deal of the problems.
As you went in, were you conscious of being under enemy fire?
Not enemy fire at all, no. There were lots of mines on the beaches and obstructions which, had to be got through. But most of our we had a team of underwater divers who would dispose of most of those anyway. We had a free run into the beach, we weren't bothered at all.
So as the LCT moved into the beach on D-Day, what was the job of Jimmy the One?
Well, you had to see that all the gear for the door was ready to be released and let down as you touched the beach, and so the tanks, unscrew all the bottle screws, get the tanks ready, see to the anchor. Of course, you anchor by the stern in an LCT so you can pull yourself off again. You had anchor going in, and then see to all the release gear of the door, see the door went down smoothly, and get the tanks out.
Did everything go smoothly?
Not bad at all. Not bad at all. As I said, I do a D-Day once a week rather than go back to Brooke once a year.
Did the Americans seem grateful?
They were staggered by the whole thing. I mean, the immensity of the amount of ships that were going down to that morning was beyond belief. It really was incredible. And I don't think anybody guessed what these enormous great Mulberries were. You know, we brought our own harbour with us, and nobody guessed it, at least we didn't anyway. There were ships everywhere. And yet, as you came down to your beach, you know, you hauled off to starboard, almost like a review at Spithead, and it all went beautifully.
And on the further trips that you made, did you run into problems with the enemy?
There were shell fire, or I suppose they were tanks from inland somewhere shelling the beaches. Yes, that happened a few times.
Did you always go into Utah Bay?
No, Utah and Omaha. We were attached to the Americans. We did those two beaches.
Was there much difference between the beaches?
Utah was the roughest one early on, but I would say a week after D-Day, apart from, you know, spasmodic shelling from a tank or two, it was pretty easy going, you know, shuttling in and shuttling back to Portland.
Did the beaches look different?
Oh, yes. Well, they began to look different after D plus 19 was a most unprecedented gale from the southeast, which made it, the wind was onshore. It's called a lee shore. It's all in the book. And then, there were destroyers and frigates and corvettes all thrown up on the beach. Absolute chaos.
What was the most senior American you carried across, do you think?
Oh, a colonel. We had a colonel here in Portland. I'm glad you reminded me of that. He came ashore with very little personnel, just all kinds of vehicles, and we invited him into the wardroom to use as he wanted to on the trip over. And almost as soon as he got there, he unwrapped a parcel from home, all kinds of goodies which he shared around among us, you know. And he had a big packet of what turned out to be uncooked popcorn, you see. And we expressed surprise we'd never seen this before. And he said, well, give me a clean bucket. And this is a colonel, a full colonel. He goes down in the galley, you know, with a clean bucket, a bit of butter and some treacle, and he brings back a bucket full of popcorn for us. Can you imagine a British colonel doing that?
No. So LCT 6 to 8 was undamaged in all this work?
Only by the weather. Of course, the weather knocked us about badly, because as September and October come, of course, that's the breakup of the seasons, equinox, and we came back through some pretty stinking gales. But, oh, over there on D-Day, yes, we kept afloat all the time. Instead of trying to get ashore, we stayed off in the gale. And we stemmed that out for, 3 days and three nights.
As the summer turned into the autumn of 1944, where did the LCT go to then? The same beaches?
Oh, yes. All the time. Yes. We did go into Le Havre once. After they freed Le Havre, we did one trip into the port, which was knocked to pieces. There's no jetties left there, nothing, just a banks of rubble. And then, of course, we paid off eventually when January came. The invasion was assured. They were going up the coast to Arnhem and all over the place, you know, well into Europe. And they captured Cherbourg, which meant the bigger ships could take more stuff in. And we were sent up to the Orwell River to pay off.
Was that the end of the war for you?
No. I went for a command course then. I was sent back to Troon for a command course. And as a very junior, a senior sub-lieutenant, I got command of a LCIL large, landing craft infantry large. And I took her out to Cochin in India.
You sailed her all the way to India?
Mm-hmm.
Through the Med?
Yes, through the Med, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did this LCI large compare with the LCT?
Much better living conditions, because they were American built. We had telephones to and from everywhere. We had a wardroom which looked like a wardroom with drawers and shelves and places to put our gear. And we had a can't think of the name now, a gyro compass, which is in our English Navy only destroyer sported. They were a great help.
What was the official name and number of this?
LCT number 11.
LCT?
No, I'm sorry, LCIL 11.
Is the L in brackets?
Yes, please, yes. And I left her in Cochin on my demand number, number 26, came up to Bombay, then came home in the Ile de France, and that was it. We took off our uniform and went to work. Nobody counseled us in those days. After 6.5 years, now they take them down to the Falklands for 6 weeks. They've got to be counseled when they come back. Wonderful. That's progress, I suppose.
On the voyage to Cochin, were there any mishaps, or was it all plain sailing?
Pretty plain sailing. We had bad weather across the bay, but that's to be expected. But nothing we couldn't handle. When we left them, of course, being American craft, they had to be steamed to Luzon and paid off there to the Americans. Of course, when they steamed, where was it, somewhere, two were lost in the typhoon. Two of the six that were going to Luzon were lost, so I gather.
So you made this voyage with another five, did you?
A whole flotilla, except that I was left behind in Plymouth. I went to Malta on my own to catch up the flotilla, which had gone on before me.
What kind of a crew did you have of that?
Well, the same kind of people, chaps from Birmingham and all over England. I mean, chaps who've never seen the sea some part of their lives. It's amazing how quickly they settle down. Staggering.
Did they do a good job?
Oh, yes. Oh, not without some... You know, I mean, you need a good petty officer. He's the chap who knocks them into shape, you know. You say what you want done, and he's got to get it done.
Was there any trouble with the discipline since it seemed to be right at the end of the war?
They began to get a bit truculent then, because of course they couldn't see what it was all about. Here we are, the war's over, and we're steaming out of the Far East. Yes, I had a bit of bother over drinking of rum and one thing or another, but that's easily stopped by watering their rum, and they don't like that one little bit.
So they detected it.
Oh, yes. It's the biggest punishment. I mean, rum is no longer issued in the Navy, you know, but I mean, then, among the rum drinkers, the biggest punishment ever is to water their rum. Oh, it's frightful.
So you tell them you're doing it?
Well, if one misbehaves himself, you punish the lot. You water all their rum. And they put the problem right, don't they?